Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Royal Society for Public Health lecture. Those of you who were at the opening session yesterday will know that this organisation is very new, in fact only 3 weeks old. It's a UK NGO very much involved in health promotion and health advocacy approaches. However, the Society has been formed from two very well-established organisations in the UK, and we have had an annual lecture here at the APHA conference for a considerable time. Today, we are going to be talking about regulating health and social care with and without borders, and this is going to be in two parts, basically. Hopefully, the two will then come together to form a united whole. I'm going to be starting with an example of an already well-established regulatory system in the UK, and that is the educational regulation system. And the purpose of this is to give you some feel for how the UK itself has approached regulation of public services. This will then be followed by my colleague, Dr. Mahmoud Adil, who will talk about the context of regulation in health and social care, which is very new in terms of what he is going to talk to you about. This is something that in England we've been looking at new approaches for some time, and in many ways it has been built on our experience of previous regulation systems. So I'm going to be talking then about experiences of the educational system. My background is as a director of education for one of the local authorities in England, and also as an inspector of schools. I have to tell you that I have no relationships to disclose. This is a compulsory aspect of all the sessions at this conference. And I want to start off by talking fairly generally and briefly about why regulate public services anyway. Now, clearly there are lots of potential reasons, and if we went around the room, I'm sure you'd give me 100 reasons why we should be doing this. But in many ways, it is context specific. But there are some aspects which I feel actually cross over context, and that's what Mahmoud and I hope to show this morning, that there are fundamental reasons for ensuring that public systems are well regulated. Clearly, one of the first ones must be to ensure that those services are effective, since they are ones which are paid from the public purse, and the public has every right to expect that those services are fit for purpose, particularly in meeting what they're supposed to. Very much having transparency and accountability to the public so that everybody is aware of how well those services are operating. Clearly, value for money, particularly in these economically difficult times, and ensuring that there are proper risk assessment strategies built into the way those particular activities operate. And secondly, there are clearly a lot of human rights issues, particularly when we're talking about health, social care, and education. And that relates to very much access to services, ensuring that there aren't barriers, effective representation of groups and individuals in how those services operate, and again, ensuring that all those services do take proper consideration of health and safety. It also is important that these services are there to protect the public by ensuring that the staff who are delivering those services are properly qualified. Clearly, that's one of the big issues of all regulatory systems, to ensure that that is the case, that there's appropriate CPD, and that any improvements within the system are built on good, recognized practice, not simply whims of individuals who feel they want to change systems for whatever reason. The resources are sufficient. That's not always easy, but that's something clearly regulators do need to look at. If the service is to be provided, then the resources should be suitable for that means. And where there are weaknesses in management or staff, then those issues are addressed properly. I'm going to talk about the English experience then of regulating schools against that background, and you'll see what is a fairly typical English school there on the one side, and some fairly typical English school children happily going on their way to their establishment. Many of you are not au fait with English education systems, and I just want to say very briefly something about, first of all, standards in English schools, and then something about the education system in England. The state education system has got a long history of central control. It has very much been a dominating central management which has controlled the educational system in England. And that includes also the levels of their performance. Inspection was introduced very early on in England. In the 19th century, there were a large number of inspectors who toured the country, making sure that schools were effective and that children were safe. There was, however, after quite a fairly sort of reasonable position in English education, where schools did quite well, everybody seemed quite content, a lot of concern in the 1970s, because schools didn't then seem to be meeting the needs of society. And there was a big debate in England. It was called the Great Education Debate, led by the Prime Minister at the time, in fact. And it followed very much, pardon me, it followed the issues around the oil crisis in 1974, when, of course, Britain, like many other countries, started to find it didn't have the resources in order to meet its economic developments. So at that point, government started looking for ways of changing and improving the standards in education significantly to meet the national need. And that's important because it wasn't so much about just individuals in education, it was about what the state needed from those individuals and the schools. But one of the issues in trying to get those changes, it was difficult to persuade the stakeholders involved to actually agree to those changes because there wasn't sufficient evidence. So what about the system itself? Well, it's a free, nationally planned, locally managed state school system for most of the population. Roughly 90% go to state schools in England, so it's funded by central government. There are also independent schools, fee-paying ones, and some home tuition for a few children. That's a parental choice, by the way, that children in England can be taught at home if their parents wish them to be. They can teach them themselves, in fact. But that's a very small percentage. Most children go to state schools. Compulsory school age is 5 to 18, which includes training and further education at the top end. School numbers, in comparison to the states, very small, but 17,000 primary schools, 3,500 secondary, 1,500 special, 2,000 independent schools. There's planned early years provision from ages 2 to 5, which is now available for most children if the parents wish it. And there's a compulsory national curriculum for all state schools from the age of 5 to 16. We also have a rigorous, very centrally imposed system of attainment testing at certain key ages, 7, 11, 14, 16, 17 and 18. But recently, the government has decided it will not test children at 14 in the same way as it has in the past. So what about regulating education quality? Well, the way it's done in England, there's a number of approaches to this. Analysis and publication of all the school examination and test results. Publication of comparative school league tables, and I know this is very similar to what happens in the States. But we have an Office for Standards in Education, the so-called Ofsted, and I'll say more about that in a second. We have a dedicated cyclical school inspection system, so schools are inspected on a regular basis, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. Inspection reports of schools and the school data is published for all to see. Individual school governing bodies exist with local representation. And we have local education authorities, approximately 180 of them in England, which have responsibility for not controlling schools, but for providing the necessary school places in their areas. The important aspect of what I want to say this morning is the Office for Standards in Education, Ofsted. It was formed in 1993. It's led by an appointed chief inspector of schools who is technically responsible to the Queen, but in reality is responsible to her board. It's independent of government, but it is required to annually produce reports on the standards of education in the country. And it was deemed necessary in order to improve the control of student performance, both in education and in the schools themselves. And it's now been extended to early years provision. So it not only is about schools, but it's also about childcare prior to that. It took over the inspection responsibilities of what were called originally HMI, Her Majesty's Inspectors, who were appointed by government to actually oversee the whole system, and some local authority inspectors who worked more locally. But these were seen as too accepting of the status quo, and the system was changed in 1993. And what happened then was inspectors were trained specifically to work for companies. The system was privatized, and the companies employed inspectors who then did work on behalf of the regulator. There was some HMI maintained and retained in the system to oversee the overall progress of that. So what are the functions of this regulator? Well, there they are: to ensure schools are fit for purpose, particularly in the achievement of their youngsters, monitoring the quality of services and standards, evaluating the quality of professional practices and processes, making sure that the views of the stakeholders locally are met, and disseminating and sharing good practice. And not a lot of difference there, I think you'll see, between that regulation system and other regulation systems. What about the roles of inspectors in all of this? Well, this is laid down in the Education Act in England in 2005, and you'll see that it's very much about checking on the quality of what's going on in schools. So it's about how far the education meets the needs of the range of pupils, so it's about access. It's educational standards: are children meeting the requirements and meeting their potential? What's the quality of leadership in the school like? Does it actually meet the needs of the teachers and the children? And interestingly, it looks at things like spiritual, moral, social, and cultural development as well. And it also is about contributing to the well-being of the pupils. But interestingly, this is about the only reference to the health aspect of what schools might be doing. And in England, there is very little attention given in schools to health education at the moment. The methodology which is used by inspectors: short notice planned visits, very often just 2 days' notice, and inspectors will turn up in a school. Looking at how the school is doing over time in terms of its key indicators. Looking at how well the school is doing locally compared to similar schools. Looking within the context of the inspection at lessons: how well are teachers teaching, how well are managers managing. Talking to the stakeholders, particularly parents, employers, local business people, about whether the school is effective. Assessing the organizational and managerial systems in the school: are they fit for purpose? And using data from the school to make value judgments. So it's quite a hard-hitting system, as you can see. Not much is left in terms of how effective that school is. One of the things that they're able to do, because they have a lot of statistics which are collected nationally, is to compare the school's performance against national performance. And this is an example at the end of year 9, where the performance of the children in the school can be seen in English, maths, and science against the national figures. Now, all of this is available nationally. Parents have access to this data, so they can say, well, this particular school isn't doing as well as the national statistics. But of course, what it doesn't say is what the context of that school is. And that is a concern which we'll come back to shortly. Another example: this is at the end of year 11. It talks about how many children are getting what is known as the General Certificate of Secondary Education in England in terms of the school and the national figures. The school's own reports are very much used. So it's a self-evaluation system in a way. The school is expected to say how well it thinks it's doing, what its plans are, and the inspectors evaluate those plans and those development targets against the reality of what they see. The quality standards checklist, which Ofsted produces about what the school should be doing, any business and strategic plans, financial audits, and any local targets. So again, you can see it's quite evidence-based, this inspection. Then it's about assessing the school's outputs. Again, this is mainly about examination results. How good are they? Should they be better? What's the quality of teaching like in order to meet those targets? And any performance indicators which are built into the school. The stakeholders are asked to give views on the school itself, things like access to the school, reputation in the locality, and any anecdotal information. And very much inspectors do talk to people about their feelings about the school, even though it's not heavily evidence-based. They listen to staff viewpoints, both school staff in teaching terms and also management. And they then use the inspection evidence in certain key ways, producing evaluation reports for the organization and significantly for the public. So anything the inspectors say is then published so that it is quite clear and transparent. It's used to disseminate good practice where there is good practice. In certain cases, if the school isn't doing well, then the school is referred to Her Majesty's Chief Inspector, who will name and shame the school in the press and say that school is not up to standard and it has given so long to actually improve. School governors then are expected to create action plans and to set targets. This is an example of a headline taken from a report on a school which shows this is a particularly good school, in fact, but this is what parents get. This information is given to them about this school in their locality. So as a parent, you would have access to this, and you could decide whether you wanted your child to go to that school or not. This is a headline statement, but it obviously gives quite critical evidence to the parent about whether this school is suitable. This is also available to parents. This is much more detailed. The figures on the side are a 1 to 5 scale. 1 is excellent, 5 is needs a lot of improvement. And you can see that there's a whole range of things here which are evaluated on that scale, which parents can see. Following an inspection, as I've said earlier, governors must set targets and agree development plans. And the local authority is also empowered to use its regulatory powers to close schools if it wishes. It has to have the evidence for doing so, but if it has the evidence, it can close local schools. It can remove leaders, governors and staff, and appoint new ones. And it often uses external consultants, if necessary, to improve school performance. So the powers are very much about saying if the school isn't doing well, something has to be done about it. So the power of the regulator is quite considerable. There are also things called thematic inspections, where HMI, Her Majesty's Inspectors, will also look at general issues such as equal opportunities or gender issues about performance and so on. And they will also look at things like staff training and development needs. Now, this is an evolving model because it was introduced in 1993, but it's changed 5 times in the last 15 years as the model has developed. And this is in the light of experience. Whether the current model is the final one, I doubt very much, but it has moved on. And in that way, it's an important measure for what Mahmood is going to talk about shortly. The model is based on cost effectiveness because inspection is a very expensive exercise. It's a best value approach, so it doesn't always use the best methodology. It uses the most appropriate within the costs. There are often very small teams of inspectors. We have some fairly large secondary schools, 2,000 pupils, for instance, and you might find only perhaps 5 inspectors there for 2 days. Which is really quite a colossal job if you're trying to find out about a school. Mostly inspectors are generalists. They're not subject specialists because it's very difficult to find sufficient of these. And it's primarily document-based. So it's an analysis of all the information available and then decisions are taken on the basis of that information. No specific comments are made about teachers. At one time, Ofsted did report on individual teachers' performance. That is no longer the case. There was quite a strong argument against that by the teacher unions, and that was accepted. Schools are rated as outstanding, good, or requiring some improvement. There's a re-inspection cycle, which for good schools might be as much as 6 years. For poor schools, it might be as small as 6 months. And again, the regulator is there looking to see improvement. Schools in special measures, those that really are finding it very difficult to perform, could well face a closure. The report published for parents and students is on the Ofsted website, so everybody sees it. There's naming and shaming of schools used in appropriate circumstances. Inspectors very much look for their own evidence to either verify or disprove what the school itself is saying through their self-assessment process. And strangely, and I find it strange as an inspector, there's very little use made these days of classroom observation, which is of course the centre of most learning, because that is quite an expensive exercise, having enough inspectors to do that in sufficient depth. And mainly the process is now through discussion and interview. Not all teachers then are seen teaching, so it's not a perfect model in any way, because you might miss the poor teachers or the better teachers. There's little contact made by inspectors with parents and governors, and there's minimal notice given, about 2 to 3 days. So, how well has it worked? Well, this is a quote from Her Majesty's Chief Inspectors of Schools last year, and you'll see it's saying too many schools are still inadequate, about 1 in 12 of the maintained schools, which is quite a percentage. And she talks about the starkest example, where the poor levels of attainment and attendance of many looked after children are simply unacceptable. And that's quite a stark message, I think, to be giving to schools, particularly after 15 years of a regulatory system. So the failures of the inspection system in England, well, the problem is it doesn't address contextual and process issues sufficiently outside the immediate focus. So there's little attention given to the community context. The wealth, the background, the nature of that community isn't always taken into account, neither are social inequalities. And therefore, comparing schools isn't always as effective as it might be. It doesn't relate very well to the conflicting lifestyles, ambitions, and expectations of different groups of pupils and parents. So it tends to be a one-size-fits-all model in many respects. There's an emphasis on judgments against nationally determined priorities rather than local ones, and that's because England does have a very centralised education system. And there's too little consideration given to wider educational aspects, particularly health and well-being and cultural differences. So, moving on now to the essential bit of this session, what has this all got to do with the health and social care systems? Well, both obviously have high levels of accountability to clients, particularly to the local inhabitants, taxpayers, and of course central and local government. They're both very complex organisations with a wide range of stakeholders. They both have very large public budgets. There's a need to focus on client benefits, not simply the benefits of the system for the state. And outcomes as key determinants of organisational achievement are both in both systems are essential. The processes are driven by the need for professional staff to operate efficiently and safely. There's a need for effective management systems in both systems, and there is a requirement for substantial CPD. And both have local government overview systems. So that's basically the position I want us to be in at the moment. And I'm going to hand over to Mahmood now, because that's the background in terms of a system which has actually been set up to operate in England. Mahmood is now going to talk about a system that's emerging partly from that.